the first question. Thank you so much for the additional information on practicing sounds of silence. I've known of the sounds of silence, but not that there was any quote-unquote formal or structural practice around it. I'm wondering if Ajahn Chah did any teachings on this, or his predecessors, or if there are suttas related to it. Much gratitude. This is something that Ajahn Sumedho himself came up with, and so that I've never heard of any of the Thai traditions using anything like that. There's, in terms of suttas, not in the Pali suttas, there is, I'm trying to think of the Mahayana Sutta that goes through all sorts of different meditation techniques, and there's something similar to that taught by Manjushri Bodhisattva, if I remember correctly. Anyway, it's that's about all that I know around that. Oh, right. Yeah, there's and also in the compilation of Ajahn Sumedho's, so that there's both a small booklet by, or reasonably small, a booklet by Ajahn Amaro describing the practices, and then Ajahn Sumedho's anthology of his teachings. There are teachings that he's given around that, and those are all available in the Four Sangha publications, PDF, EPUB, MOBI. What are the suttas related to the list of virtuous qualities that Ajahn Kurundamo spoke of so eloquently in his Dhamma talk?
Sorry, what was the sutta?
Yeah, so it's in Anguttara 8, you just go to Anguttara 8, the numerical discourses, the 8s, and look up Aniruddha Sutta, I think that's the Aniruddha Sutta. And I think it's just called the Aniruddha Sutta. I can't remember the number. Okay, how do you apply mindfulness of the body in terms of jhana practice? Well, as one breathes in, one breathes in mindfully. As one breathes out mindfully. And grounding awareness in the body. Also, as the whole Anapanasati Sutta is grounded in the body, in the sense, I mean, it's referring to the different foundations of mindfulness, but every single bit of the 16 stages of the mindfulness of breathing is with that awareness and mindfulness on the in-breath and the out-breath. And then as the mind becomes more settled, all of the images that the Buddha gives for the developing of the jhanas is images that are grounded, rooted in the body. So the image that the Buddha gives for the first jhana is the bathman's apprentice, taking soap powder and kneading it so that it the water is evenly distributed through that powder. And it holds a consistency, and that image of it permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this body, in the same way with the pleasure joy of happiness arising from withdrawal, with solitude, so that there's as the mind becomes more settled, one is suffusing the body with well-being and being able, it's not just sort of trying to block out anything, one's actually consciously drawing that well-being, that pleasure through the whole body. And the second jhana is the image is of the lake that is spring-fed, the water coming up from the bottom of the lake, doesn't have any water coming from anywhere else. There's no sort of streams or rivers coming into it. It's just this lake with the spring coming up, this cool water coming up from the bottom, and it permeates and pervades, refuses and fills the whole lake with this cool water. And then the Buddha is saying, in the same way one permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the happiness born of concentration. So that the images of jhana practice are all connected with the body. So mindfulness of the body plays a huge role. It's not a disembodied practice. Yeah. Where is the middle way taught in the suttas, and how might that help some of us who consider extensive sitting an ascetic practice? So I guess different people have different middle ways. It's right from the very first sutta that the Buddha taught. Pretty much through to the 45 years of teaching, to the end of his life. This middle way of practice and a middle way of teaching, so that the practice based on virtue, on concentration, on wisdom and discernment as a middle way, a practice of training, and then a middle way of teaching is a way that avoids sort of extreme views of either being or non-being, eternalism, nihilism, so that this middle way but it's also a middle way that leads to the end of suffering. It's not a middle way in that it's a compromise where you can cut out the hard bits and sort of split the difference so you feel good about it. There's aspects of training that are essential. And it's just that when the Buddha is using this middle way as a way into balancing the mind, balancing our life, balancing the faculties that we have, so that we can see and understand things clearly. It's the nature of the mind that kind of veers off into different kinds of extremes that clouds the mind and hinders us from seeing clearly. So the I would say the middle way is it's a practical tool for freeing the mind, as opposed to some idealized middle way that is some doctrinal position. It's a middle way of a balance, and that's why the very first night, I can't remember, where somebody asked the question about just the structure of the Eightfold Path of being, right and wrong, and what is and that this, when the Buddha is speaking of right and wrong is what takes us to suffering, right is what takes us to freedom from suffering, and right is not sort of some kind of, again, some sort of doctrinal right, but it's the word that the Buddha used is a word that comes from musical theory, so that it's more in terms of it's right in tune, or just right. It's just balanced. It's right in terms of harmonizing with each of the other factors, and harmonizing with a goal of freedom from suffering, so that this middle way of practice is one that one is tuning in to freedom from suffering and being able to realize it and experience it. I am tangled up in self-identification and conceit. What should I do to get myself out? Thank you for your wisdom and your kindness. Well, you and a whole lot of other people, I'm so self-identified and conceit. It's suffering, the whole schmear. That's why it's so important to come back to the that experience of what's it feel like when I my perspective or my experience is always either self-referential or the need to compare and compete with others, and it's a burden that we're picking up and carrying, and to be able to be alert to what burden am I picking up now? What am I carrying that's completely extraneous and unnecessary? Of course, sometimes it feels self-identification in me is absolutely necessary, but it gets burdensome. Being able to reflect, investigate, pay attention to that feeling of when we pick up that sense of me, and the burden of identifying with the body, or my feelings, thoughts, emotions, ideas, views. There's a very different feeling when and it doesn't mean that one doesn't have any thoughts or feelings or pretty, but it doesn't cloud the mind. It doesn't create conflict or difficulty. And it can be put down to let go of, but it's not that serious. You really notice self-identification when something feels like, well, this is really serious. I've got to hold on to this. I've got to fight for this one. that's a burden. Okay. Today there was a lot of rapturous energy during the sits. It started to get to be too much. How do I work with this? Do I let it take its course, or do I try to ground it down? It's kind of exciting, and that rapturous energy. But then, you know, it's sort of like, you know, after it arises, but then sort of, you know, enough already, you know, just. But sometimes it, you know, so because then it ends up being agitating. So this is where that, again, where the body is really helpful, because that relaxing and soothing that energy, so that it's settled, it's grounded, and then it becomes more smooth, more soothing, and more nourishing, in that sense, where the energy is much more sustainable. So that way it brightens the mind without agitating it. So that bringing it to a place of some pleasure, that's the difference between sukha, piti and sukha, is that sukha is much more kind of body-based, or much more pervasive through the body. So that consciously using, let's say, a joy or rapture, bringing it into the body again, so that helps to settle it and sustain it. The image that's in the commentaries in the Visuddhimagga, delineating the difference between piti and sukha, say joy, rapture, and happiness, pleasure, is they give the image of a person who is traveling through a wilderness area, in terms of more like a desert or some very dry wilderness place where there's no water, you're out in the sun, it's really, no, it's unpleasant, it's difficult. And then as you're going on your journey, I mean, you know there are places to stop, but it just seems like you're not getting there. But then you meet somebody who's coming in the opposite direction, and their clothes are fresh, looks like their hair is wet from bathing, and they tell you that, okay, just up a little further, there is an oasis there, there's trees, there's water, there's shade, you'll be able to drink as much as you like, bathe, this, get clean and refreshed. And so that there's this exhilaration comes, that, okay, it's just not too far now. And so there's an exhilaration, that's like rapture. So you haven't quite experienced it yet, but there's an excitement that's there, so that you're sustained by that excitement. And then the experience of sukha is actually arriving there and bathing, drinking one's fill, and getting cleaned up, and being able to be out of the sun in the shade. So you're cool, you're refreshed, and it's pervading everything. So that's the image that's from the Visuddhimagga. Quote, a phrase, teacher of gods and humans, Can you talk about this? What gods did the Buddha teach? What other beings did the Buddha teach? The Buddha, there are many, say from a traditional Buddhist perspective, and in the suttas, there are many, there are different realms of beings, and some of them are interested in Dhamma, and the Buddha teaches them, so that there's teachings in the it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think, or the Digha Nikaya, and the Sakkapanha Sutta. So the questions of Sakka, he was the head of the Dawa Tingsa Heaven. I'm not very up on these things, had a whole variety of teachings, and he was a god with right views, a very sort of high level god. Did we do that last night? Teaching on the highest blessings. That teaching is a teaching that a deva comes to the Buddha and asks for a teaching of what. And there's all sorts of. I think in the preamble to it, or maybe in the commentary. Anyway, these devas are debating, and everybody's got different views and opinions of what are the highest blessings. And one of the devas, I'm not really getting an answer here. Maybe I'll go ask somebody else who's got a bit more authority. So goes and asks the Buddha, and that's a very ordinary. So devas, beings that are in other realms, not so much. Only think of what's coming to the lower realms. Did the Buddha teach lower realms and everything? Oh yeah, well there's this account of when this elephant was released to harm the Buddha, and kind of enraged coming, and then the Buddha spreads loving kindness and then teaches it. So it subdues this wild elephant. So there's many other beings that the Buddha is teaching and giving guidance to. In the Sangyutta Nikaya, the first several chapters are all sort of like Deva Sangyutta, Deva Putta Sangyutta. And so there's several of the first few chapters are teachings that the Buddha has given to beings in other realms. I'm thinking of Ajahn Chah, and he was somebody who didn't talk much about other realms. I mean, there's some monks who are kind of the boundaries between human realm and other realms are fairly permeable. But Ajahn Chah was really and you tried to keep things really straight and tangible, because I mean there can be a lot of weirdness invested in the, in the either in beliefs or in stories or in speculations and suppositions, it can get very complicated. So Ajahn Chah was very keen on keeping things really down to Dhamma. And he would almost never speak about other beings in other realms. And one time I was sitting with him and it was just myself and it was this lay person came who was a devout layman, and he had a question specifically about something that he'd experienced, a being from another realm who said they were from Wat Bapong. He followed him the last time he'd been to the monastery, followed him back home, and so he said, "Was this real?" And Ajahn Chah, "Oh yeah," and it was just sort of like, "Oh yeah, he lives in such and such a place in the monastery," and then he started talking about the other beings that were there, and the head being who he sort of everybody else was kind of looked up to, and how he had he got a lot of faith in at first he didn't really want anybody in his forest, but seeing the practice that was going on, then he got faith would come and listen to teachings all the time, and he got so much faith that he decided he wanted to follow the training. So he started taking on the practices of 8 precepts, being in white and following the routine, and coming to the teachings, following the whole routine of the monastery. And he said, "Yeah, it didn't last very long." He ended up sort of disrobing from from being in white. He said, "That's too odd. It's too tiring." That was just hilarious. And it was Ajahn Chah just sort of talking about it. So I think we live in a very material world, and the teachings of the Buddha are valid within that scope or that sphere of knowledge, but I think the traditional teachings have always pointed to other realms of existence, say rebirth over multiple lifetimes. So it's the Buddha was a teacher of gods and humans. Okay. What does the threefold bliss mean in the verses of sharing an aspiration? And I'm trying to remember. The first one, you remember? It's the first one. Because
in this very life and then the blessings in the next
life. Yes, yeah, I think that's how it works, yeah. So the sort of bliss that one experiences in this life in terms of happiness that arises from good actions, virtuous life, in this very life that we're experiencing, and then heavenly bliss in the sense of when we if we pass away and then we experience the bliss of fortunate realms of existence, and then the bliss of Nibbana, so that the bliss of full liberation. A few days ago, you mentioned the four powers. Could you say more about them? I'm thinking that what was it, Idipadas probably, the basis of success, I'm not sure, yeah? Okay, so those are part of the structure of the 37 wings to awakening, and so these bases of success, bases of actually could also be translated basis of psychic power, so that chanda is the first one, chanda as desire, as motivation, interest, virya as effort and energy, jitta, the application of the mind, or the mind being able to become focused and steady, so say the power of samadhi, and vimamsa as investigation, contemplation, and vimamsa as say as investigation. In this sense, there's several terms that are used for say contemplation, investigation, and this vimamsa has a connotation of reviewing, so that one's reviewing experience, reviewing, reflecting on experience, or reflecting on circumstance, or reflecting on knowledge. So it's like it's a way. And what happens, of course, in these that base of that will generate more desire or motivation, chanda, and sense of interest will increase. So it's a there's a cycle that works in this, so that the cultivation of these four bases of success, almost always they are referred to in as something that are important aids in the establishing of concentration of samadhi, so that in order for say samadhi to really establish itself firmly, there needs to be interest and motivation in a meditation object, an ability to lift up a balanced energy, to be able to apply the mind steadily to an object, and then for the mind to reflect on what happens as one's directing attention, how to modulate, how to balance, how to deepen that steadying of the mind. And then, of course, that tends to keep the mind. These qualities are not exclusive to meditation. I mean, they're applicable to daily life. I mean, you don't do anything without having some kind of interest or motivation in terms of any particular project or task. You know, one has to lift up some motivation, some interest. You know, completely bored and fed up with it, it's nothing much happens. So it's, and then you have to be able to, you know, bring some kind of effort or energy and seem. So these qualities are actually, whether it's in daily life or in some meditation and long-term cultivation, these are qualities that we need to rely on and become familiar with, skilled with. Okay. Does having no craving mean doing things in the world knowing they won't bring lasting satisfaction? For example, planning a vacation, realizing that it will eventually end, or taking measures to cure a headache without expecting one to feel completely without it. I'm trying to understand how this will look in real life without one becoming apathetic and depressed about meaninglessness of basically all activities except meditation. How to balance ability to still enjoy life with abandoning all craving. I think some of the happiest people I've met are people who are accomplished in relinquishing craving. So one is recognizing that one, there's a difference between craving as, say, desire, and that it, something that's bound up with greed, hatred, delusion, self-identification, obsession, that's always going to end up in suffering and no lasting satisfaction from that. But being able to apply oneself to, setting goals or desiring to do things. Sometimes the motivation shifts so that it isn't about me so much as about benefit, well-being, about sharing, or of goodness, or virtue. So that there's a different motivation. And then desire arises, and that's more like chanda then. So then it's like a wholesome desire to do something that is somehow useful, somehow beneficial, something that's enjoyable in a way that doesn't create sticky entanglements and complications in our life. So then there's one delights in a certain simplicity or and it doesn't mean one can't plan a vacation. I'm planning a vacation. I'm going to Hawaii. It's true. I'm going to take my mom there. every year or two, I sort of decide to sort of figure out maybe a couple of years, and every 2 years I try to take my mom somewhere that because she's 93 now or something. And so try to do something that's special for her. And getting out of Canada in February, that'll be special. So that, take her to Hawaii. So, and I think I'll enjoy it too. It's not totally self-serving, but so I mean, it's sort of thinking in different ways, those are when it's cast, or you see a bit bigger picture, and then you plan things, you do things, and on a certain level. Yeah, it doesn't really matter what we do; we're going to die anyway. But you don't hold that as a. I mean, that's on a logical basis, but you don't live your. You have to have that as a certain perspective, but you just keep harping at it, so that you do make yourself miserable. It's just sort of that recognition that there are certain things that are enjoyable. You do them. A lot of it is when it's shared with others. That's really that's where it changes a quality. It's something that's of benefit, not just for oneself. Can you speak more about vedana and whether it's something to be changed, as in from dukkha to sukha? Vedana as a basic feeling one experiences the feeling tone of things and recognizing that when one does or says things, there's going to be a certain feeling tone that will arise. In the sense of, if I put my finger in this light socket, it's going to be dukkha vedana. So you, one refrains from that, or if it's already in there, you want to pull it out. So you get that and then experience a change in vedana. But and certainly that sense, but vedana is kind of fundamental, so that we do want to be paying attention to the conditions that do arise in painful, uncomfortable, difficult feelings, and to learn how to cultivate the conditions that will facilitate the arising of sukha, of vedana, that is pleasant. But in saying that, because it has a different effect on the mind, say dukkha vedana, and we're not ever going to be, say, completely free from dukkha vedana, in the sense there's stories in the suttas where the Buddha himself is, he's been teaching for some time, and he asks Sariputta to continue teaching, because he says, I'm sitting here for a long time, my back is killing me. and he goes and has to go lay down and rest his back. So that it's just looking after the dukkha vedana, recognizing that even if one's not creating a problem out of it, or one's not intimidated or fearful of it, sort of, it just is naturally has a different effect. So that one is paying attention to conditions, and that's what the cultivation of the Eightfold Path is, a paying attention to the causes and conditions that will lead to more pleasurable feeling and lead to a cessation of dukkha. Okay, when I tried to quote-unquote fully experience the body, I seemed to hold the in-breath too tightly, causing tension in the abdomen. Do you have any tips for loosening up the diaphragm or the belly area? Thank you. Just loosen up the diaphragm and the belly area. Because this is where... again, that's where we take an instruction, and this is how we learn balance as well. In the sense, if we haven't really heard that teaching or tried it out in terms of or seen it as a perspective, fully experiencing one, so that that sounds like a good idea, and. And of course, it's the Buddha's teaching. It must be a good idea, so I should do it. And then we do it, but then it's still a bit theoretical or a bit, it's not natural yet. So then it creates some tension, or causes some, you know, we're trying a bit too hard. So then you notice, okay, I'm trying too hard. I need to relax. I need to just soften and just let this loose. And then after a while, one finds, slumped. I'm falling asleep. And there's this experience and knowledge that you're gaining by doing it. And that's where the confidence and clarity really starts to establish itself. And so that just learning how to experiment and being, the Buddha is giving us the encouragement and the, hopefully the confidence to experiment, try things out, because that's how we learn. And that as we do that, and as we are attentive to the result, the feeling, tuning into, well, what is it that is, what am I experiencing more of here? More dukkha or more sukha? And then you say, that's how you learn, that's how you adjust. Say skills are developed just by in the doing of it. There's two questions here. Please demystify jhana a little for those like myself whose vipassana past has had minimal samadhi focus. The emphasis on calming and brightening has been so, so helpful on this retreat. So insightful. Whereas in the past, I associated deep concentration with vipassana elites and insight practice more for those living in the mess of the world. Now I wonder, in our post-election universe, whether a more jhanic or balance between practices would prevent overwhelm / hiding / running to Canada. Thoughts? Absolutely. There is a lot of, there's a need to demystify jhana somewhat, because it's like Ajahn Chah, when he very rarely would mention jhana, because it would even in the human condition, we sort of focus on it and then we kind of make it into something that is really special, and something so special that it becomes kind of rarefied or reified even. And what these states of well-being and settled mind and heart, they're accessible by our turning attention to it. And I think also, just as one of the earlier questions, of integrating the settling of the mind with a settling in the body, we've got this tangible anchor base of experience, which we can keep relaxing and keep permeating and pervading, suffusing and filling with a sense of well-being, a sense of ease. And as that ease becomes more, there's more continuity, and mindfulness and awareness becomes more steady, then the mind really does settle. It's a natural natural feature of the mind. And, you know, some people are more, say, more adept or more, their temperaments are more able to do that quite easily, and some aren't, and I'm one in the latter category, and so that it isn't that easy. But the thing is it's more of a, you know, like a mindset that one, you know, lifting up that possibility, and then bringing those qualities into the mind, and then nourishing that with, say, like the qualities of Dhamma, say, faith, patience, compassion, discernment in the sense of not being clever, not being overly thinking things, but discerning clearly. Then one brings that back and reflects on our experience, and then the mind keeps that keeps letting go, and the mind keeps settling. So it's a natural process. And whatever one calls it, because sometimes we get really obsessed with, you know, what did I attain, and that kind of desire to measure and quantify attainment is a obstacle in and itself. So just being said, oh, this is peaceful. Okay, how can I look after that peace? How can I look after that well-being? How can I nourish that and nurture it? So that's what we pay attention to doing. That's the approach that Ajahn Chah use. It's just, you know, whatever helps the mind to establish itself in wholesome conditions, be clear and steady, and experience an inner well-being, just keep doing that. And it'll take you in the right direction. The second question there is a crack in everything, that's where the light gets in. Leonard Cohen, quote, lots of cracks out there, lots of potential for awakenings and wise, compassionate action. Do you agree? If so, where do you see the light emerging? In what arenas? Where would you focus your energy if you weren't a monk? Thank you. I have no idea where I'd focus my energy. I've been a monk a long time. And I was drawn to this. Whatever the case, the world, you know, there are these opportunities for compassionate action, and I think have to really pay attention to the opportunities for supporting a kind of communal or social harmony. There's so many ways that we can be divisive or dismissive quite easily, and it's even more important now to be really, really attentive to the ways in which one can be give time, give energy, give attention to things that foster harmony, foster a sense of mutual support, not in a kind of my group, my clique, but as human beings, and to be able to do that. And I think also, let me say, You know, and light always emerges from a say a younger generation, really nurturing younger people in some way, nourishing that the potential for goodness is there amongst everyone. But you know, I think to really nourish younger people and give them something that's really hopeful. How do I deal with a negative person? His or her perspectives, most in the way of a downside, pointing out people's faults, his or her bad experience, etc. If that person is a life partner or family member, how to turn him or her to become better? Sure, there are a lot of conversations today, Thanksgiving dinners, that are all about this. But it usually ends up in a big argument. So, it's, you know, I think they, you know, sometimes it's you really have to, timing is everything. It's so important to if one's going to say anything at all, and sometimes it's not worth it, but if one's going to say anything at all, timing is essential, in the sense of somebody has to be ready to hear something, or this, it has to be at an appropriate moment where it becomes clear what one is pointing out, and it's not just dismissed or reacted to in a negative way as well. So sometimes being patient enough to wait for the right time is a real skill, because sometimes you. Doesn't really matter if you're right or not, but what's important is that you give advice or give encouragement or give perspective at the right time. Okay. Thank you for sharing your wisdom on the Anapanasati Sutta. It's been such a gift. Could you explain if the steps need to be experienced sequentially? That is, does sukha always need piti before, or can one experience sukha after calming the mind without piti every single time, with immeasurable gratitude? No, this doesn't have to be sequential at all. It's sometimes it's helpful to have structures that you work with, just to remind one, or to you know, the mind does need structures in order to have a game plan. But within that, one, there's lots of room for again coming back to experience. What seems helpful? What's the experience? What works? What are our areas that are, say, what didn't work before, and then it might be interesting to pick up and try again. So those are one's using the practice in a way that basically you can access at any point, but there is a certain sequential encouragement in grounding attention in the body right from the get-go, but then it'll unfold in its own way, and there's some areas that just seem one skips over and it works on another piece that seems grabbing attention or seems relevant at the time. So you've got lots of ways of accessing it, playing with it, experimenting with it. And that's the beauty of, say, 16 steps down upon a satya, which you've got lots to play with. It's hard to wear it out. I'm grateful to all the monastics for their teachings and living your life according to Dhamma, being different from conventions of this society. I grew up in the environment where any difference was met with hostility. I was bullied, I was robbed a few times, I didn't feel safe. No wonder the idea of the refuge always resonated with me, and I found the refuge not only in the Dhamma but also in this country, creating a safe environment to be different. However, even after living in very tolerant California for many years and generally feeling myself safe here, whenever I'm outdoors practicing walking meditation and I see or hear strangers approaching me, my mind begins to rush in anticipation that this encounter would turn hostile, and being on precepts makes me feel particularly vulnerable. Could you share some teaching about protecting qualities of the Dhamma and how I can feel less fear while keeping the precepts? Could some of the monastics share their stories of receiving unexpected kindness from seemingly hostile strangers, or stories of resolving physical or verbal attacks against them in a skillful way while wearing the robes and keeping the precepts? Thank you so much. But I think one is just to recognize that say, as human beings, we are vulnerable, and if one has had experience of being threatened or being say bullied, abused in some way, there's a logical reason why one has a certain fear and anticipation, so that it's not unreasonable. But it's also it can be countered with qualities of protecting qualities of the Dhamma, and how as one keeps precepts and keeps a certain integrity, then and is harmless. That's one of the things of keeping precepts, is that one's quite harmless, and other people feel that, and they might not feel or see that immediately, but one story comes to mind of a monk being on a train. He's going to a teaching event in England, and I was over a weekend, which I think ended up being sort of a policy to try to avoid the train travel on the weekends. So the football hooligans are a presence in England there. And then as I think it was a monk and either two monks or a monk and an anagarika, I can't remember. Anyway, they were definitely dressed different than the football hooligans. They're drunk and they're making all sorts of comments but the person didn't respond and wasn't fearful, and just had a calm presence, and then It didn't take long. I can't remember the whole story. It's a long time ago now. But the head hooligan came and sort of started talking and then ended up sort of engaging in conversation, and then the monk had some things to say, and it sort of made the person kind of reflect, and then started sort of sharing and opening up about his life, and ended up sort of crying and you know, being sort of all, you know, sort of having a sharing session with the monk on the train, you know, very, and you know, ended up being quite a sweet encounter. So those things happen. Just as a monastic, then being helped by people in situations that normally one wouldn't expect. Thinking of the story of Ajahn Gunha, when he's a very good monk. He's still alive now, was walking Tudong in the forest along the western border of Thailand, and it was in the days when there were still a lot of communist insurgents in the area, and he happened to wander into an insurgents' camp, and they were really hostile because they thought he must be a government spy, because he'd walked through, because the whole area was mined, and he just walked through the minefields, and he didn't know. He was just on Tudong walking through the forest, and he got a hostile reception, and they questioned him for quite some time, days, this guy's for real, he's a monk, some days later they escorted him out of that area, passed through the minefields, out to where he could continue his journey. And then they went back to their camp, and then they started talking, sort of, you know, it's really nice having you here. We should go and invite him to come back and spend the rains retreat with us. So there's a whole bunch, a whole contingent of them sort of trekking after him, and caught up with him, and invited him to spend the rains retreat with them, to be able to teach them. But he said no, he wouldn't be able to, because he'd made commitments in other places. But that was began as a hostile confrontation. But it's just that presence of integrity and virtue and peace was something that had a stronger impact. And you know, I think as monastics, we've all had occasions where we get people are either suspicious or you see that in, say, like maybe not suspicious, uncertain. So that, you know, say like Ajahn Sodanto going to live up in White Salmon, going alms around every day, when he first started going there, I'm sure it was sort of, you know, what the heck is this? And then now it's a real expected and a very welcome presence, seeing monks and alms around. It's a real, even if, and there's, of course, there's many, many people who are making regular offerings, but even for those who do, I'm sure that it's a real, just having that presence each day and has a big effect. And similar, Ukiah, the same. Willits, we go, and these are sort of real American towns, and the people are respond in a very warm and trusting way after time.